Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do you know the story of early America? As a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, one-time history major, and author of two best-selling works of history, Tony Horowitz figured he was pretty well up to speed on the important details of our shared past. So he was astounded to realize, following a trip to the remarkably disappointing Plymouth Rock site, that he knew almost nothing about European exploration of this continent between Columbus's fateful trips and the Pilgrim's arrival. So he set about to find the stories of those 128 years that are lost to many Americans, and sure enough, he discovered the history of those years is every bit as dramatic, as tragic, as triumphant, and as fascinating as the rest of our nation's past. Horowitz's new book is called A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. Tony, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Why is it that so many history books start with the Pilgrims?
I think it's just a myth that was created really roughly 200 years ago, that this is the beginning of the American narrative. And we've clung to it despite all the evidence of how much happened before the Pilgrims got here. They were latecomers, not firstcomers, but at least that wasn't the way I was taught in school.
Yeah, that myth would have us believe that the country was really settled, at least when it came to Europeans, from east to west, when in fact you discovered that it started first in the south.
Right. Columbus never actually reached what is now the U.S., but in the decades following his sails, Spaniards began coming from north, really, from the Caribbean and from Mexico, to explore originally mostly the southern fringes of our country. And they got to places like Texas and central Kansas, even, before the East Coast, long before the East Coast was settled.
So you looked at what happened between Columbus and the Pilgrims, of course, but he was not the first European to arrive here. You started with the Vikings. When did they get here?
Right. Well, we really need to begin the story 1,000 years ago when we're talking about the European story. Obviously, the native history goes back thousands of years before that. But the first Europeans that we know of to reach North America were the Vikings, who landed in what's now northern Newfoundland and established a colony and were there on and off for about 15 years.
How much were you able to rely on Norse mythology and poetry and sort of oral traditions to figure out the story?
Yeah, our principal source for the Vikings are the wonderful Icelandic sagas. And these were stories originally told around the hearth 1,000 years ago and were written down in medieval times by clerics. And for many years, historians regarded them as a very unreliable historical source because they're filled with the supernatural. But in 1960, a Norwegian adventurer studied the sagas closely and looked at old maps and other information and was able to locate this place referred to in the sagas called Vinland that Leif Erikson settled 1,000 years ago. So there is actually useful information in there, even if all of it can't be taken at face value.
You did have a hard time sort of combing through the text because so many people have the same name.
Yeah, it's quite comical in a way to a modern reader. You know, there'll be a character named Thorstein, and then he meets someone else named Thorstein and a Gudrid who then encounters a ghost named Gudrid. It can be a little hard to keep track of the cast of characters.
So it must have been really stunning for the first Vikings and the Native Americans to discover each other for the first time. What do we know about those interactions?
Well, unfortunately, we only have, in that instance, the European side of the story. The Vikings viewed natives with contempt, really. Their word for them was skraeling, the Norse word, which is, translates as ugly, screeching wretch, or some variation thereof. Unfortunately, we don't know what word the natives used to describe these pale, hairy strangers who appeared out of nowhere.
The beginning of cultural sensitivity, I'm sure.
Exactly. They were not quite as sensitive as we might be today. And they describe encountering these people on the beach and, for unexplained reasons, instantly kill them, which is a kind of a disturbing harbinger of what was to happen in later centuries so frequently when Europeans first encountered natives.
Well, and as it turns out, the Vikings really were no match for the skraeling, as they call them.
Right. We think of the Vikings as mighty warriors, and in fact they did subdue many European peoples and Slavs and Celts and many others that they conquered. But in Vinland, or in North America, they encountered natives who were much more numerous than they were, well-armed with bows and arrows and catapults. They attacked the Vikings with fleets of canoes, and the Vikings ultimately realized they wouldn't be able to stay. So in the first recorded contest between Europeans and natives, it was the home team that won.
Yeah, I guess at the end of the day, what the Vikings didn't have that later colonists and settlers did was waves of fresh supplies and fresh live humans.
Exactly. They were really a satellite of a satellite. They came mostly from the colony in Greenland, which was already the sort of furthest frontier of European society at that time, and there were really only a few hundred of them who came to North America. So it's perhaps not all that surprising that they weren't able to cling to their foothold here.
Tony Horwitz is my guest. His new book is called A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. We should stop and point out here that this is really a travelogue as well, and you went all over the world trying to find out the story of the settlement of this country by Europeans, including going and spending 4 hours in a sweat lodge?
Well, when I went to Newfoundland, I decided to try and track down the descendants of the Skraelings. And as best we can tell, they are the Mi'kmaq Indians of eastern Canada. And I went to their powwow, their annual powwow, and they invited me to join them in a traditional sweat lodge. This was something I'd never done and naively thought was going to be sort of a locker room sauna. And I stumbled out 4 hours later feeling as if I'd been cooked alive. It was quite an ordeal, I have to say.
And somebody would stick his head out the door and yell, "More grandfathers!"
Yeah, grandfathers refers to the hot rocks that they pile in the center of the sweat lodge to create the heat. And I was told that the most intense sweat is called a bear sweat, where there are actually 56 hot stones in there by the end. We didn't quite reach that pinnacle of suffering. I think it was 42, but it was still a considerable sweat.
You were afraid that there was blood coming out of your pores. You were so dry.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, there's no more perspiration there, but you're still kind of leaking. And I thought I was going to lose consciousness at several points. And I'd like to say that my consciousness and spirit were raised by this experience, but frankly, at the time, they were crushed.
I guess you have a European ancestry?
I do. My forebears were Jews from Russia who came here about 100 years ago.
So no match for the Skraeling still.
No, they've been here a little longer than me and a little more familiar with American rituals.
Okay, well, let's go now to Columbus. You pointed out before that he never set foot in America. He landed on Hispaniola, which is now the Dominican Republic and Haiti. Is that right?
His first landing on what's now Columbus Day in 1492 was in the Outer Bahamas. And from there, he sailed on, yes, to Cuba and Hispaniola. And then he made three later voyages to America, where he went all around the Caribbean, Central America, South America. But he never set foot on what's now a U.S. territory, which makes it rather odd, actually, that so many places in this country are named for him.
Did he understand that there was a vast continent sort of just a few hundred miles from where he was?
No, Columbus really had a very misguided vision of the globe. He thought he could sail west from Spain and, as he put it, in a few weeks reach Asia. He thought it was only about 3,000 miles. It's actually about 11,000. And there's also, of course, this enormous continent blocking his path. Yet to the end of his life, he clung to the belief that when he arrived in America, that what he'd reached was the Indies, as they called it in that day. And just the further he went, the more convinced he was that he was close to China and India, when in fact he was in places like Venezuela.
So were his navigational and cartographic skills, were they sort of up to the standards of the day, or was he in fact subpar when it came to other people who were living and working at the time?
I think he was a great mariner and navigator, but he was not a great geographical thinker and not really a great explorer, in that he found what he went looking for in the first place. He had such a strong image in his head of what he was going to find, the riches of the Indies, that he almost was incapable of seeing what was before his eyes. So he's a fascinating figure, but not exactly in the way we were taught in school of the sort of brave visionary navigator. He was really more of a medieval mystic knight errant, I think is a more accurate way to look at him.
He did have contact with Native Americans, people who were living already here on the continent or off the continent, but in this area. Can you talk about how his descriptions really framed the perception of Native Americans by Europeans for hundreds of years?
Right. From the minute Columbus arrives, he begins writing in his journal about the Indians, as he calls them, because he thinks he's in the Indies. They're actually the Taino people who sadly were driven into extinction by Europeans shortly thereafter. Right away, he begins noting words, for instance, that are still with us: canoe, tobacco, hammock, many other things that have entered our lexicon come from those first encounters that Columbus had. He also saw them really as innocents, almost as children. And I think there was really the beginnings in Columbus's writing of the sort of noble savage myth that grew and expanded over the centuries.
So tobacco was an instant hit. Obviously, lots of people were looking for gold, and sassafras was something that many people were seeking.
Right. The one of the things that Europeans brought back to Europe from America, other than tobacco and Indian slaves and all kinds of other things, was syphilis. And it was believed in that day that the cure for a disease could be found in the place that it came from. So since syphilis came from the New World, so must its antidote. And herbalists of that day latched onto sassafras. Which, you know, it tastes a little like root beer when you turn it into tea. It's kind of medicinal. And I guess they therefore thought it could act like, well, as we now know, penicillin does. And in fact, the first English to explore and settle New England were not pilgrims seeking religious freedom, but Englishmen seeking to get rich by finding a cure for syphilis.
And some of those guys came back with really unbelievable tales. I mean, you'd think that even in Europe, where people hadn't seen the New World, they would not have believed the stories that were coming back.
Yeah, I mean, some of them told stories that simply weren't true. A number of these people had very lively imaginations. Probably the liveliest of all was a man named Amerigo Vespucci, who claimed to have sailed to America, even reached the mainland even before Columbus, and I'm talking here about South America, and wrote, for instance, that the women were taller kneeling than the than European men were standing, that they were sexually insatiable and couldn't wait to, you know, make love to these European men. He basically told his audience what they wanted to hear. And as a result of that, to this day, we're named for him. The name America comes from Amerigo Vespucci, whose accounts, which were entirely fanciful, were instant bestsellers in Europe.
Well, it's like Penthouse or something, right?
Yeah. As one person has observed, his letters from America read a little bit like those letters in Penthouse Forum that I gather are written by the editors themselves, sort of imagining these wild orgies. That's a little bit of what Vespucci's writing is like.
So at what point did people start to... that's all right. You got some other noise going on. You know, we're going to take a break right now anyway. So
okay.
We'll come back in just a minute. Tony Horwitz is my guest. He's an author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His newest book is called A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. It looks largely at the time between the adventures of Christopher Columbus and the arrival of the Pilgrims in 1620. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tony Horwitz, author of A Voyage Long and Strange, which is now out in paperback. He'll appear at Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art next week. Details are available on the Think page of KERA.org. Tony, Juan Ponce de Leon had been with Columbus on his second voyage, is that right?
That's second or third, yes.
Okay. But he was still a young man when he came back with his own ship and found Florida, so he was not really looking for the Fountain of Youth?
No, that's another myth. The Fountain of Youth was actually an ancient myth that these waters were a cure for impotence. Not only was Juan 39, but he had already fathered four children. And there's nothing in the historical record that suggests he was seeking this fountain. But what he did find was a lush shore he called Florida. And this was the first confirmed landing by a European on, you know, territory that's now the U.S. So by the logic of naming countries after their European founders, we should really be perhaps the United States of Juan rather than America.
Yeah, it's funny that Vespucci gets so much credit
right,
in terms of naming rights.
Never came near here.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Eric in Fort Worth. Hi, Eric.
Hello. I was listening to your program and really enjoyed this. I recently read a book called 1421, The Year China Discovered America. And they discuss in that book about the Chinese coming up through Florida and along the eastern seaboard. I wondered if any of that research had come into your book. Mm-hmm. And also, the Norse people had left the runestone markings in Heavener, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. at the state park there. They've dedicated a whole exhibit. And I was curious if any of that had been in your research, and I can take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Right. As to the Chinese, frankly, I don't think there's any substance to it, at least as presented in that book. It's certainly possible, but no real evidence of it has been found. And I felt that the evidence cited in that book really doesn't stand up, and I don't know any scholar who thinks it does. You're right about the park in Heavener, Oklahoma, and I do refer to that in the book. Again, I'm sorry to be such a downer here, but there's no substance to that either. There's no evidence the Vikings reached U.S. territory, but there are dozens of these alleged runes all around the country, I should add, in landlocked states like Oklahoma, because there was sort of a Viking craze, and people felt they were finding evidence of the Vikings everywhere. But again, there's no substance to that.
So there's not even a chance that these things were sort of brought down from Newfoundland and deposited elsewhere by other people?
Well, I mean, I'll never say never. but based on everything I've read and talking to archaeologists and scholars, certainly not Oklahoma. I mean, there's a chance they may have gotten as far south as New England. But there have been dozens of these, and under close study, they've all turned out to be either hoaxes or, more often, scratches, glacial scratches on rocks that people interpret as runes, even though they're not.
You know, Tony, the book is so interesting to me because it strikes me that from our very beginning, and in fact, before we even thought of ourselves as a country, our identity was really formed around myth as much as fact. And people even then sort of preferred the myth.
Well, most of the Europeans who came here in this period were chasing myths, beginning with Columbus, this myth that the Indies lay, you know, just a short way from Europe, and the many others that followed. They're searching for cities of gold, for the Isle of the Amazons, for El Dorado. This is, I think, hard for us as modern people to sort of wrap our minds around. But when you read these accounts and when you see what they did, people like Coronado, who, you know, traveled 3,000 miles across America, convinced they're going to, you know, find this treasure that never turns up. I should add that they did find it in Mexico and Peru, and that's part of what drives these people. There are these occasional, essentially, gold strikes, and this creates this sort of frenzy that there are going to be other such finds elsewhere in the Americas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Eddie in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hi. I'd just like to get a comment from your guest on the whole idea. I mean, his book is, I guess, subtitled Rediscovering the New World. But just this whole idea of how do you discover something when there's already people there? I mean, this whole idea of Columbus discovering America or Cabeza de Vaca or whomever, when there were already indigenous people there who came from somewhere else, but we continue, and even people like him who are supposed experts continue. This whole discussion, for instance, on the air has kind of been around the Europeans and what the Europeans discovered and the European legacy. It continues to be amazing to me. I'm reminded, I have a friend who's a Native American who's trying to get up a trip of a bunch of Native Americans to fly over to Spain next Columbus Day to discover Spain. I mean, it's kind of the same.
Right.
It's kind of the same idea, and I think you're perpetuating it here. And I just would like to get a comment.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, it's a very good point, and I'm careful in the book to put the word discovery in quotes because obviously you're right. And it's, for Europeans, it was a discovery for them. But I'm very careful to point this out. And in fact, there's as much about Native Americans in this book as there is about the Europeans. I'm telling it around the arrival of Europeans. But the real heart of the story is what they find here. So I do write at great length about the Indian cultures that were here for thousands and thousands of years before. And this is another lost part of our early history. I think many Americans still imagine this was a virgin wilderness when Europeans arrived and that there were a few bands of, you know, roving nomads. In fact, there were vast, very settled and sophisticated cultures all across America. Of course, the Pueblos in the Southwest and also in the South in the Mississippi Valley, the great mound civilizations. Again, we tend not to hear a lot about that, so I'm hoping that this book is also reclaiming that history too. But I certainly agree with the caller about the term discovery itself is a very problematic one.
Well, one defense that you hear people use occasionally is the fact that Native American cultures didn't have as detailed written records of their ancient history. And I'm wondering if that's been frustrating to you even as a historian, knowing that there is every bit as much information about these, but it's harder to figure out and to decode completely.
Yeah, I mean, history is first and foremost based on documents. And unfortunately, we don't have, documentary evidence from before 1492 of the Americas, although there were forms of writing and hieroglyphics among different societies. But we do have a very rich archaeological record. We have very rich oral histories and religions and traditions. And, of course, many of these peoples are still here. I visit, for instance, Zuni, New Mexico. Well, the Zuni have been here from the beginning, and they haven't gone anywhere. They, obviously are a rich source of information about their own culture. So it's not that there aren't ways of learning about this, but it's not as easy as it is, say, with Columbus, where you can read his own journal and the many other writings of those who knew him.
And I guess even in terms of explorers, there had to have been some who simply didn't leave much of a record. They didn't keep journals or they didn't survive.
Mm-hmm.
And are there other explorers that you sort of thought about including, but you realized there just wasn't a wealth of information about them?
No, absolutely. I really had to make choices here because there were so many stories to tell from this period. Some of them are simply lost. We have only scraps, and very rarely, for instance, do we have maps. And sometimes we have wonderful written records, as with Cabeza de Vaca, who goes through Texas, but we don't actually know precisely where he went. So most of the time, there are great holes in the evidence, and this is frustrating. That being said, the Spanish in particular were tremendous record keepers. They were great bureaucrats. They even documented their own atrocities in great detail. So we have quite a bit. There's really no excuse that we neglect this period because we don't know anything about it. In fact, there is a great deal to work with.
Has all of this colored your opinion as a journalist about the idea that, what we write today is sort of a first draft of history?
It does, dawn on me. I mean, this was a different era. Today, that first draft is has so many more elements to it, photographs and videos, et cetera. But yes, I often thought as I was reading these accounts, well, how reliable are they? Who is it who's writing this? Is he understanding what he's seeing, particularly when Europeans write about Native Americans? You obviously have to take it with a huge grain of salt because often they don't understand their language or their customs. So I think you have to bring the same skepticism to the history of this period as I was accustomed to bringing to my journalism about the present.
This is an archive edition of Think with author Tony Horwitz. He'll appear next week at Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. Details are available at dallasmuseumofart.org. Let's go next to Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Well, first off, I'm going to have to buy this book. It sounds fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Here's some quick ones. Hudson Bay, the Red River of the North flows into it, which then feeds into the western lake areas of Minnesota. Did he do any research on the mooring stones that are numerous up in that area? That's one. Number two, was there any discussion about the ancients, Anastasi, coming down Canyon Road and trading with the Aztecs on what is now the plaza in Santa Fe? And Spaniards would always, with the plan of Madrid, lay the most their squares and the most sacred grounds of the Mesoamerican Indians, also the Indians of the Southwest. Another point, when the Spaniards did conquer and they first landed, the history of the blonde blue-eyed that would come back, and could that have been possibly a Norwegian or something, someone Nordic? And then the last one would be DNA. Has there been any? I know there's research going on about DNA evidence as part of the mixing of cultures. So I'll leave all those points to you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, there are a lot of interesting questions there. I'll try and remember all of them. I did not your first question about Canada. I talk about Canada in relation to the Vikings and a bit in relation to the French, but I tried as much as possible to focus the story on what's now the U.S., and I used the Vikings and Columbus as a sort of background to that story outside of the U.S., so I didn't go into detail about the area you described in your first question. I do talk quite a bit about the Southwest and the Indian trade routes that you talk about, and you're absolutely right, the Spanish would sort of put their own plazas, but also their churches right on top of Indian sacred ground. They were, after all, not just here for gold. They were here really on a religious mission, and they felt this was a way of sort of displacing native beliefs and implanting Christianity. It often didn't work. Your other question about DNA, I'm most familiar with that, where they're doing it. I talk in the book about the lost colonists of Roanoke and what happened to them, the 114 English settlers who are left in North Carolina and never seen from or heard from again. And there's been a lot of speculation about what happened to them and DNA testing around that as to whether they melded in with the Indians or, you know, where are they or where are their descendants. As far as I can tell so far, that DNA testing has been inconclusive. There's also a very interesting work, though, with DNA and also linguistics to understand the native history. And we're also pushing the clock back on that by thousands of years. I was taught that the first migration was across the Bering Land Bridge perhaps 12,000 years ago. New evidence is suggesting it might have been as long as 30,000 years ago. So again, there's much more American history than we thought.
Tony Horwitz is my guest. His new book is called A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. I'm glad that you brought up Roanoke, Tony. When I was a kid, there was a Leonard Nimoy special on TV about this. I don't know if you remember the one I'm talking about. But
well, I certainly remember Leonard Nimoy. I was a big Trekkie. So.
He had a series later called In Search Of, and this was the one that I remember was about Roanoke. And, of course, it strikes me, you talk about all the myths, you know, in the story. The people who come back to look for them find dishes on the table and food on the plates that's fresh and all this, you know, ridiculous details that don't really correspond with what actually was found after that happened. Can you talk about how the boat sort of dropped them off and who came back to look for them?
Right. Well, there were several expeditions to Roanoke, but in 1587, there are families, women, children, settlers, 114 of them, and the leader of the expedition sails back to England to get more supplies. And he has a hard time getting back. The Spanish Armada invades England. By the time he gets back 3 years later, all he finds is really the ruins of the settlement, sort of spoiled possessions, not what you describe, fruit on the plates, and this mysterious carving on a tree saying Croatan, which is the name of an island near there where Indians friendly to the English came from. So he thought they might have gone there, but he was unable to reach it. And after that, really there isn't a trace. So we have very little to work on, and there are all kinds of theories ranging from them simply dying of starvation to them being abducted by aliens. And it's really, I had a lot of fun in the book sort of following people who were still trying to get to the bottom of this, both serious archaeologists and some, slightly kooky folk who are also still on the trail of this great American mystery.
Yeah, there's this one guy who's basically quit his job so that he can do this full time. And it's he shares this room where he does all this world-class research in his mind with a bunch of ferrets that his wife keeps as pets.
there is, I hope, a lot of humor in this book. and there's really humor not just in the story of the present sometimes, but in these accounts themselves. Particularly the descriptions of first contact. One of the first things that almost always happens is they taste each other's food. That's what strangers do. The descriptions of the faces the Indians would make when they tasted mustard for the first time, or the disgust Indians had for garlic on the breath of the French. And so there are these wonderful kind of glimpses, very human stories of societies that have never encountered each other before, trying as best they can to communicate and get along.
And the first thing Samoset did when he met the pilgrims was ask for a beer?
Yeah. This is a story that brought home to me the fact that the pilgrims were really latecomers. Not only had there been many other Europeans through New England, there had been English fishermen and traders, and Samoset had encountered them years before, and evidently both learned a bit of English and also a taste for English beer. So when English people show up again, the first thing he says is, can I have a beer?
Tony Horowitz is my guest. His new book is called A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. We'll take more of your questions after the break. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tony Horowitz, author of A Voyage Long and Strange, which is now out in paperback. He'll appear at Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art next week. Details are available on the Think page of KERA.org. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@KERA.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. And that is where we find John in Plano. Hi, John.
Chris, hi. I have a question for your guest, Tony. Very interesting program. Wanted to have Tony comment on an earlier portion of the conversation where he talked about the Vikings being the first Europeans to settle in Newfoundland, what's now Newfoundland. Comment on the Basques. Of course, the Basques were some of the first peoples recognized in Europe, great mariners. An article in National Geographic about 10 years ago had them settling in Newfoundland prior to the Vikings. Tony, what did your research turn up there?
Yeah, the Basque are another forgotten piece of this story. I think, if I recall the National Geographic correctly, it was not, though, before the Vikings. It was before Columbus. And the theory is that we know there were European fishermen all along the cod banks around Newfoundland and other parts of eastern Canada, from Portugal, Basque, later English and French, from a very early period. And one reason there isn't much written record of it is because fishermen don't want to give away where they're catching their fish. So they didn't sit down and say, you know, I was 6 miles off the coast of Newfoundland. They kept it to themselves. And I think this is something that archaeology will resolve. It's getting more sophisticated by the day, and I think it's likely we'll find, or scientists will find in coming years, some boats at the bottom of the sea or the bottom of the Gulf of St. Lawrence that will give us more definitive information. But my impression is the first ones came in the late 1400s. The Vikings were there almost 500 years before that. So as best I know, I think it's still safe to say the Vikings were the first, but the Basque might have been the next.
Can you speak for a minute about Cabeza de Vaca? Because despite his name, he seemed to be more like a cat in that he had 9 lives. He would constantly get into trouble and then sort of find ways out of the situation.
Yeah, he's perhaps my favorite character from this whole era. And while folks in Texas are familiar with him, I have to say I'm on a book tour in the East Coast, and I tell that story, and people are astonished. They've just never heard it. You know, Cabeza de Vaca is this castaway who is flung ashore on Galveston Island in Texas and becomes a faith healer to Indians and also a trader. He's really a survivor, and he and a few other castaways ultimately wander the interior, being passed from tribe to tribe as medicine men. And in the course of their 8 years, after the beginning of their expedition, they reach the Gulf of California and go south into Mexico. And the first Spaniards to meet them don't even recognize them as countrymen because they've gone so native. To me, this is one of the great adventure and survival stories of all time. And it's also a conversion experience. Cabeza de Vaca goes from being a conquistador to a defender of the Indians he had set out to conquer. And he writes a very vivid account of this. Yet I think it's fair to say few Americans, again, outside of Texas, know that these four men crossed the entire continent 260 years before Lewis and Clark, under much more dramatic and trying circumstances.
Yeah, it certainly drives home the fact that there were, you know, Lewis and Clark had this remarkable accomplishment, but they weren't the first ones. There were many people ahead of them. Can you talk about, since we were talking about Cabeza de Vaca being sort of an accidental faith healer, because my understanding is he started doing this because they believed he could rather than him sort of presenting himself this way.
As he tells it, I mean, we only have his account. So again, that's what we have to go on. But as he describes it, they've been taken in by coastal Indians, and many of the Indians start dying from disease, probably disease brought by the Europeans, and they decide they're going to kill the surviving Spaniards unless they heal the sick. And what Cabeza de Vaca describes is sort of a blend of a bit of Catholic theater. They start saying Hail Marys, and then mimicking what they've seen of native healing rituals, blowing on the sick and other things, and miraculously they appear to recover. And based on that, Indians believe these strangers really do have the power to heal. And Cabeza de Vaca appears to believe it himself. He puts it down to divine mercy. It's hard to know exactly what was going on, but we know now that your thinking has a lot to do with how you feel, and that it's very possible that some people did recover. And really, as a result of that, he's able to go on across the rest of the country, sort of acting as a medicine man.
Unfortunately, we know that the story was much different most of the time. Europeans would come in and Native American people would get sick very quickly. What did they believe about the relationship between the Europeans, who would sometimes be among them and then leave a week later and then people would start getting sick?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big part of the story and really the most tragic part of it. Millions upon millions of Indians died in this period from diseases to which they had no immunity, and neither Indians or Europeans knew what was going on. They didn't have the germ theory back then. But there's a fascinating bit from an English account at Roanoke where an Englishman writes that the Indians thought the English were shooting invisible bullets into them. Because they would get sick. and the English themselves were fine. And in a sense, that's what was happening. These invisible microbes were being passed to them. But it was certainly a mystery, and it was obviously very frightening to Indians, and in some cases may have put them in some awe of these Europeans.
Meanwhile, the English, when they arrived, noting that the Indians seemed very healthy, chalked that up to all their tobacco use.
Again, this is the tobacco story begins with Columbus, but on this continent, it really takes off with the English arriving first in New England and then at Jamestown, where they begin cultivating it. And it's sort of darkly humorous to read about it because they think tobacco is good for you. And as they put it, it purges the humors, the bad humors in your body, which is a sort of phrasing people might recognize from Shakespeare, who was a contemporary of these writers. And they also describe smoking in those days as drinking. So they talk about drinking tobacco. So there are some very vivid descriptions of, these Europeans sort of huffing and puffing and, ultimately becoming addicted to this new weed.
We have an email from John who says, I greatly enjoyed Tony's book Blue Latitudes, in which he and an often inebriated British companion follow in the footsteps of Captain Cook. Will you comment on the differences between late 15th, early 16th century exploration compared to that of Cook in the late 18th century?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And in a sense, this book is a companion to Blue Latitudes, because in that book I'm talking about first contact in the Pacific, which occurred a couple hundred years later. And in this book, I'm rolling it back to talk about the same story in America. I think this one is tougher from a historical perspective, because Cook, writing in the late 18th century, is a man of the Enlightenment era. There's not a lot of God in his writing, not a lot of gold. He's really trying, at least, to be an objective scientific observer. He writes in a way that's easy for us to understand, and for the most part, he seems to be a reliable observer. When you're reading these accounts from 500 years ago, you're really dealing with a very different mindset that really, put simply, is more medieval than modern. The Spanish are really on a religious crusade in America as part of what they're doing. And so their writing is filled with allusions and references to chivalric literature and other things that I think are at times very hard for us to really grasp as modern-day people.
We have an email from Tom in Denton who asks if you'd comment on the alternate theory about how America got its name, which is that it was named after a Welshman who was a wealthy merchant, Richard Emeric. Have you heard the story of him?
I'm embarrassed to say that's a new one to me. But, I think certainly the scholarly consensus is that it comes from Amerigo Vespucci. And the way we know that is it first appeared on a map made by a German cartographer, Martin Waldseemüller, and he puts the name America next to this new world. And he explains in his writing that he's done this because he's naming it for Amerigo Vespucci. So I have to say that story is another one that sounds like a urban legend, perhaps. I wouldn't put too much credence in the Welshman in this case.
I wonder, the more you go back into history, the more you have to question sort of everything we know, because you find all the things that are almost passed along as fact for centuries.
Well, what's interesting is, quite aside from the Cabeza de Vacas and the other stories that many Americans have never heard of, even the characters we think we know, the true story is very different. And one quick example, John Smith. I think if you did a free association with John Smith, the first thing most Americans would say, love affair with Pocahontas. And obviously the Disney movie and many other stories have perpetuated that. Well, there's no truth to it. And there's a lot written about Pocahontas by John Smith and others. She was about 10 at the time they met, so if there was something going on, it would be rather strange and disturbing. And there's no evidence that they did have any kind of, love affair. She goes on to marry another Englishman named John Rolfe. So I found this again and again with Columbus, with John Smith, even with the Pilgrims, that what we think we know is more myth and misconception than reality.
Well, and of course, the Disney version always stops just before things get really bad. The real Pocahontas died when, what, she was a teenager?
Yeah, she marries John Rolfe, and they go back to, she has a child with him, and they go to visit England, and while she's there, she and her son become very sick. It's unclear with what, perhaps tuberculosis. And before they can return to Virginia, she dies at about the age of 19. So really, her story is more a tragic one than a romantic one. And it's not just Disney. Some of your listeners may have seen the movie The New World about Jamestown, which I thought was quite wonderful, except once again, they couldn't resist perpetuating this myth. And they had Colin Farrell as John Smith, even though John Smith was sort of short and hairy and not very attractive. We have Colin Farrell sort of frolicking around with this beautiful young woman in buckskins. Well, it's just there's no historical basis for that.
I guess it's a matter of who you'd rather look at on the silver screen.
Yeah, fair enough.
An email from Ed in Dallas says, we often think of the earliest English colonists of the 16th and 17th centuries as directed toward the upper and middle Atlantic coast. Are you familiar with the archaeology that indicates an English colony on the north side of Galveston Bay?
Oh, my. Your listeners have come up with a lot of the things I don't know about, and I'll have to need to go back to the books. I don't know about that, but I do talk about, and maybe this is what it refers to, the first English sort of wanderers we know about in what's now the U.S. were essentially castaways again from an English ship in about 1564 or 5. Or maybe one or two years later anyway, in the 1560s, and it's a fleet that's in trouble, and they just unload a lot of men on the Gulf of Mexico, and they wander all the way to the Atlantic. So it's possible that this Galveston settlement has some connection to that, but I'm sorry, I don't know about it.
Have you had to change your relationship to the value of myths and sort of look for truth, not just factual truth, but sort of truth in essence that comes from myth, or do you have to be careful not to do that?
Well, at the end of the book, I talked to someone who makes an interesting point. I've kind of come to the end of the trail, and I'm back in Plymouth, and he says, you know, you're right. The facts show that Plymouth was not first, that, you know, the Pilgrims were latecomers, and that this is really a story we came up with after the fact. But as he put it, a myth is more powerful than fact. Myth we choose, we create, we perpetuate. History is really just a set of random events. I think there's some truth to that. I wish it weren't so, because I think myths can also be very destructive. But I think we do need to recognize that people have always cast back in search of a story of their origins. It's very hard to just accept that we came out of what was really a very chaotic and, in some cases, accidental series of events, that the story wasn't meant to end the way it did. We prefer to create an uplifting narrative that connects what happened then to our values and to our story today. So I think myths of this kind will always be with us.
Tony Horowitz's newest book is called A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. Tony, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.